Welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events and anything else that happens to fall out of my yammering mouth. Welcome, everybody. Later in the show, we will have Mark Klass on. He's going to talk about the case of missing Dylan Redwine, and we have some amazing documentation put together by Web Sleuth members. We'll be discussing that documentation, and it is absolutely amazing. We don't need no flipping mainstream media. We have Web Sleuth sleuthers getting out all the information we need. Mark will weigh in on the missing teen. And later in the show, one of our all-time favorite people, a Candy Rose, will join us to give us the latest in the murder trial of Dee Dee Moore. She's on trial for murdering homeless lottery winner Abraham Shakespeare. It is a wild case. And if anyone has the scoop on this case, it's ACR. But first, I remember listening to Sean Hannity. This was in February 2007. I was yelling at my radio because I think he's an idiot. I remember this very just as it was yesterday, because he had to stop and announce to the world that Anna Nicole Smith had been found dead. Hannity then tried to return to his ridiculous topic that I was yelling at him about, but he wasn't able to, because all anybody wanted to talk about was Anna Nicole Smith. Well, Hannity finally gave in, got off his ridiculous topic, and it was actually one of his better shows. Now, we've all watched Anna Nicole Smith. We've judged her. We've laughed at her. And I think we all knew she was going to die, especially after the death of her 21-year-old son, Daniel. Now, more than 5 years later, people are still wanting to talk about, to know about, and to find out every little detail they can about Anna Nicole Smith. Tonight, I welcome movie director David Giancola. Mr. Giancola wrote, directed, and edited the new documentary about Anna Nicole called Addicted to Fame, but there's so much more. Also joining us is true crime author Donna Kaufman. And Donna, I want to turn it over to you for a bit, because you are familiar with Mr. Giancola, and I want you to do the proper introduction, because this is not just about a documentary. There's a whole lot more going on here. So Donna Kaufman, take it away, my dear.
Thank you, Tricia. Thank you, and hello, Web Sleuths. Back when I was writing with Dr. Cyril Wecht, our book called A Question of Murder, which is about the deaths of Daniel Smith and later his mother, Anna Nicole, I got to know Dave Giancola, who was the director of a film that was made at the time, he was making at the time, called Illegal Aliens. And it was a spoof, and he very graciously gave me some photos that we included in the book. And then that the whole coming to the marketplace for that film is the basis of his new documentary, Addicted to Fame. And just to tell you what Dave will probably not tell you, because he doesn't, you know, I won't say he's shy, but he is a really well-known director in Vermont. And he has directed TV movies and feature films that star people like Jesse Eisenberg, John James from Dynasty, remember that really hunky guy, Billy Ray Cyrus, and Illegal Aliens was kind of an over-the-top Charlie's Angels type of spoof, and the other co-star that you would recognize is Joni Lauer. And so the making of documentary that is now coming out into the theaters, and it is available on download now, Addicted to Fame, is the story about how Illegal Aliens was made and kind of ruined by Anna Nicole and her team. So, Dave, take it away, pal.
Well, thank you so much for that double wonderful intro. That was really great. I really appreciate that. I'm very glad to be here with all of you. So, thank you very much. You know, what can I say? I guess the first thing that I could say is that I made Addicted to Fame, which is a documentary, as you said before, about the making or the unmaking of a fictional film called Illegal Aliens that I made. I made it really because we had the footage. We were shooting kind of a behind-the-scenes reality show at the same time. And I made it because I had that footage. And within reviewing that footage, I realized that there was some truth there that were not self-evident in any of the media coverage that came out during Daniel's death, during Anna's death, and during all the craziness that ensued. You know, even from when she was pregnant. And it's not so much a rehashing of her story as it is a telling of my story and the people around us who wanted to simply make a goofy B comedy, and how that all turned bad due to the excesses of celebrity and drugs and alcohol and all of that. And that's really the story. And also the excesses of the media, you know, and how they handled it. And I think by extension, and this has come out of the film being out now for a few days, the people's voracious appetite for everything that was Anna Nicole for whatever reason at that time.
But David, let me ask you something. You mentioned when you first started talking about some truths that are out there that weren't evident before. Can you give us a hint, or maybe not a hint, how about tell us some of those things about Anna Nicole Smith that might surprise us?
Well, I mean, one of the things that for me was important, because I'm a parent, this is a woman who was worth and or blew through millions of dollars, was adored by millions of people, was very famous. And at the time I hired her, her career was at someone of an ebb. But we were filming, Addicted to Fame, the basis of the movie, the documentary Addicted to Fame, is the fact that we had two cameras running behind the scenes every day, all throughout the shooting of Illegal Aliens, and 10 days before and 10 days afterwards, and then it kind of goes off the rails after that. But one of the things, I mean, after we finished Illegal Aliens and it kind of imploded due to everything that happened to Anna, I walked away from the film business for a year, year and a half, and I produced a Hallmark Channel movie and other things. But I put that footage away. It was too painful to watch, but one day I started pulling it out, and this is more of a personal thing, but one of the things that struck me as amazing that I discovered from the footage, and this was her own admission on camera, was that Anna said, quote, she don't read too good, which means she was what they call, I guess they call it functionally illiterate, which is a nice way of saying that she basically couldn't read. You know, so for everything that she gained in this world in terms of celebrity and financially, It never bothered to anybody around her or to herself to learn how to read. And I just thought the bankruptcy of that was stunning, and that was kind of the catalyst that made me move forward with the film.
It is stunning.
Yeah,
and
stay
it's
school, kids.
There you go. Don't become Anna Nicole Smith.
That stripper bar is not a good alternative.
Exactly. It's almost like they wanted to keep her stupid. Now, we're talking with David Giancola, who wrote and directed the movie the Aliens movie. What was it called again? I apologize.
Well, Addicted to Fame is the movie that's now in release, in theaters and on all your download and all your cable platforms. But it's about the making and the unmaking of Illegal Aliens.
Illegal Aliens, that's right. That's what I wanted. Okay, first of all, let's just kind of go through this briefly, David. You have Illegal Aliens. My computer went down, so I didn't have my computer screen. That's why I couldn't remember the name.
Right.
You were making the movie. You approached them. Anna Nicole Smith signs on, but you said basically she and her people ruined it. Can you give us a little bit of background? I imagine that she's very intensive, very high maintenance type person, right? She and her whole group just ruined the whole thing.
Well, I don't think it's quite as simple as that, but what happened was at the beginning when we first started, we approached them and they came back and said not only did they love the idea, they wanted to become partners and invest in the movie and be creative partners as well, which is a director of a little bit of experience. I kind of thought my leading lady is going to be my business partner. This is a recipe for disaster. And I kind of at first said, no, let's move on. Let's find someone else. But they were coming on as financial partners, and they were coming on. It was very sweet at the time. She wanted her son, Daniel Smith, to be credited as an associate producer and for us to treat him as kind of an apprentice producer and kind of teach him along the way. And again, those were all warning bells for me, because I don't want to be teaching a kid how to make a movie while I'm trying to deal with making a low-budget independent movie. And then I've got my leading lady, and, you know, but they did a draft of their notes on the scripts, a draft of their notes, and we moved along. And, you know, it all seemed to feel like she had this good sense of humor about herself and was willing to play with her public persona and tweak her public persona in a way that I thought was, I obviously was seduced by it. It was tantalizing. It was only until we got a few days into filming where we learned things like she couldn't read, couldn't remember lines, and she would add things to the screenplay that she couldn't, you know, get out in terms of physically, you know, speaking the dialogue that led us down this disastrous road. So she really kind of.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was going to say she really couldn't speak. She couldn't say her lines because number one, she couldn't read it, and it sounds like she couldn't pronounce some words too.
Well, that's true, and what if she was focused on something and she was clear-headed, then you could get some stuff out of her. And it was funny when she was clear-headed. Frankly, she had, you know, a bit of talent there and a lot of comic sensibility. It was only when the drugs seemed to intrude that it all kind of went downhill. And for us, somewhere near the last week of shooting, they got word of the Supreme Court. Supreme Court was going to hear their case, and it was amazing. They completely lost interest in the movie. And if you've seen the movie, you can see everything kind of really goes downhill fast.
Well, it almost makes you wonder, you know, here they think, hey, the Supreme Court, it was a case against her ex-husband, husband that died, and it was against his family, his brother, he was a billionaire, and they were fighting over money. And basically, you have to wonder if they thought, hey, here's our gravy train coming in, the Supreme Court's going to hear it, here's a gravy train, we'll win, we don't need to worry about anything else. Was she always on drugs, and what drugs was she on that you know of?
Well, here's the thing about, a lot of people have come to me with the film, they said, you know, gosh, this is a movie that every film student in film school should see, and I've had people who are involved in drug addiction say, you know, this is a movie that people who are involved in drug prevention should watch, because the truth that, you know, what I was very big on, I started out with a lot of anger, but I ended up, you know, in 2.5-3 years of editing, I ended up focusing mostly on the truth, and here's the problem with people doing drugs, especially pills and those kind of things. And I've dealt with in my career quite a few celebrities that were on, you know, they were abusing substances of one kind or another. And alcohol is much easier to spot, but prescription drug abuse is really hard to spot because you don't see them taking the pills. You don't see, you know, even, you know, if they were shooting up, you don't see any of that. It's done in the privacy of a trailer or something like that. You only are left with the residual behavior, and as a director and a human being, you're trying to deal with that and figure out what really is going on. And she also had a bunch of people around her protecting her, making excuses, covering for her. And so, you know, I can't speak to what drug she was on. I can't even tell you exactly when she was sober and exactly when she was bombed, because that was in post-production on the movie. There are some scenes where we think in retrospect she was clear-headed, but audience members, you know, in screenings would say, no, she's definitely high. You know, so I never in the movie say that, you know.
Right. Donna Kaufman, go
one
ahead.
One of the things Anna did, and I knew her from another project before I wrote the book, is that she wanted to be dippy. She wanted to seem out of it so that when she was out of it, you couldn't tell. It was all part of her design. And if you watched the E! Channel series that she did, that was playing up the way that she would stumble around and not be able to say things. But on Illegal Aliens, she brought in a guy who was her acting coach, and he basically had to say the lines and she would repeat them. It was like working with somebody who had severe Alzheimer's or something.
So in other words, she would be standing there filming, her acting coach would say the line, she'd say it, and then he'd say the next line and she'd say it, and that's how you had to do the film? Oh my God.
A good majority of the film was done that way, yeah. In addition, we had a script supervisor who would feed her lines for the other actors off camera so the other actors could perform, and then eventually we never could loop, which is, you know, replace certain lines even by her reading them. So we had basically, the script supervisor got very good at mimicking Anna, and in the finished film there are scenes where she's doing Anna's voice, and we dubbed it with a, you know, with an impersonation. I hate to admit.
Oh, wow. So is Illegal Aliens, did that hit the theaters? I apologize. I never really heard of it.
It did not. It went straight to video in 2007 and, you know, immediately was thrashed by the media types as an exploitation of Anna Nicole Smith because we tried to, it was a comedy, and we thought, well, we're not going to release it right after her death. We're going to hold it as to, you know, when there will be the right time. And for the media, there's never a right time. There's only the time for them to kind of take their shots and, you know, get their red ink. And so we waited as long as we possibly could financially, and what happened was when it hit video, it went right to the, you know, I hate to say the discount bin, but it bombed, and then, you know, the pirates got a hold of it, and there was this want to see in the public that people wanted to see what this movie was, and that was when, you know, internet piracy was really kind of coming into the fold, and most of the money was made by the internet pirates and not by us. It was pirated.
That's too bad. That's awful.
When I was writing the book, I get into all of her drug, you know, history and her personal history, the history with the man, the husband in her life, and also her life with Daniel, and how she was, above all, a really good mom. She was trying to find a career for Daniel, who was a very shy kid, and I think she was well-meaning. And Dave said that some of the script changes that he made were really kind of smart and very in tune with what his mom wanted. But the overriding thing that is with Anna is that she had this Marilyn Monroe fixation. And I get into this in the book in great detail. She lived for a time in the house where Marilyn died. She had a tattoo on her leg that was Marilyn's face. She had one of her dogs, which Dave has to tell you about these dogs, was named Marilyn. But she also died because she took a drug that hasn't even been heard of since 1962 when Marilyn took it, chlorohydrate. So she was even self-medicating herself with the same kind of downers and benzodiazepines and drugs and all sorts of things that Marilyn did. But she also had this view in her mind that a movie star doesn't show up on the set, is difficult to work with, and I think that might have also been a factor in Illegal Aliens.
Let me ask you something.
True.
Oh, go ahead, David.
Well, I think that's true, and I think it's interesting. That's an interesting point, Donna. Is there a doctor alive that would prescribe chlorohydrate in this day and age?
No. And it's very difficult to find. I mean, it's really something that I asked two doctors about it, and they had to look it up because they didn't know what it was. So it is, you know, it's long gone. But please, let me say another thing about the documentary. Even though it is about the sad deaths of two people, there's a lot to laugh about in this film because this – Dave heroically weaved a wonderful documentary out of 400 hours or hundreds of hours of footage that he had, and it's very lively and funny. But you have to talk about the dogs, please.
Okay, well let me. I'm going to talk about the dogs next, and then we unfortunately are going to have to wrap it up. But I have one question here, and this was one that I wanted to ask, and one of our chatters in the chat room also brought it up as well. And that is, let's talk about Howard K. Stern. Did he keep her drug? Didn't he just, wasn't he the one feeding her the drugs and making sure that she was always stoned so he could get her on video to sell? I mean, wasn't he the real scumbag here?
I don't portray him as the scumbag, and I didn't see him as the scumbag. He may be smarter than I think, but I don't know that to be true. I saw a lot of deliberate behavior on Anna's part, and I saw a lot of deliberate behavior on Howard's part, but I don't think that you can, I don't think there was that Svengali type of thing going on at that time, although he could be very good at hiding it. I don't know for sure. I think I mentioned a bunch of times that in the movie that, you know, Howard seemed like he couldn't control her. But that's what I saw. What the truth was behind closed doors, I don't know. What I will tell you is that right now, as we're talking, something current that's going on, I know that Howard is really running the estate, and Howard is running Anna's daughter doing this new Guess Jeans ad, which just came out, I think it was last week. Something that I warned him about back in, back when Danny Lynn was born, that, you know, and Anna passed away, that, you know, you've got to keep this girl as far away from the business as possible.
Right.
And, you know, behind, and had engineered the whole Guess Jeans thing, and probably lots of other things. And I think that that's, you know, he's in charge of the estate. There's no question about it. And he engineered this Guess Jeans thing, and I know he's engineered, he's very tight with Entertainment Tonight, and he's engineered a bunch of stuff with them. And I know in the past, for a fact, he sold interviews to them. So,
well,
you know,
and they have a Lifetime movie coming up.
They have a Lifetime movie coming up.
They never did collect, by the way, from the dead spouse's estate.
No.
That's actually still kind of in the courts, but it's not looking good. And my book gets into all of the quest for money and how he engineered money.
Mm-hmm.
But Anna is always the one calling the shots, just like Michael Jackson. If you stand between Anna and her drugs or Michael and his drugs, you get fired. So whole thing, everyone around you is in service to you trying to get the drugs.
Yes. We're talking tonight.
Donna's 100% right about that.
I believe it. We're talking tonight with Illegal Aliens director and writer David Giancola. He has also released a brand new documentary called Addicted to Fame about Anna Nicole Smith, and it goes into some amazing detail about this very tragic figure. Donna, we're going to get to your book in just a moment, but to kind of tie things up, I want to hear this story about the dogs. Anna Nicole Smith brought her dogs to the set, and apparently it didn't end there. David, why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. You know, Addicted to Fame, the important thing with me in telling the story, and the original first cut of the movie was 4.5 hours, and you know, the finished movie that you will watch now is about 99 minutes, hour and a half. And, you know, we didn't want to have it all be doom and gloom, and some of the truths were funny, and some of the truths were pretty gross. And Anna brought her, we filmed in Vermont, and she lived in California. She brought all her dogs with her. And the amazing thing about them was that they just did not ever, these dogs defecated all over everything. I mean, they ruined, they had a $6,000 cleaning bill at their suite of rooms in the hotel here in Vermont that I had to apologize for, and they paid for. We had one makeup and dressing room trailer, and they brought the dogs to set. So not only did we have to make sure that we would keep the trailer far away from where we were filming because the dogs were yapping constantly, they would defecate all over the trailer, and we had to hire someone to clean the trailer every night. And it's amazing how, and I'll never forget this image, and I'll leave you with this. You know, it's not Addicted to Fame, but it's true. When she, the day she got the notice that she was going to appear in front of the Supreme Court, she got roses from all over the world and flowers from all over the world. And shortly after they left, and we literally poured her into a courtesy vehicle, and they left, and I went back to the hotel room with an assistant. There were roses all over every surface of the room, every table of the room, and on the floor was all dog feces and urine.
Oh, my gosh. So we have the beautiful roses, but then in reality, her life is just dog feces all over the room. That's a very interesting kind of way to look at her life. David Giancola, thank you so much. And how do we get this documentary? Let's put it up on Web Sleuths, because I would like people to see
Absolutely. Addicted to Fame is in theaters now, but the easiest way and the way that most people are really going to honestly get it is through, you know, Comcast or Time Warner or iTunes or Vudu or any of those. You know, it's on almost every in-demand, on-demand platform, and it'll be out on DVD. I think we're looking at a March release for DVD. But right now, you can see it online on your cable system, or you can go to any of the numerous, you know, real, credible online places. You can download it and watch it tonight.
Oh, thank you. Yes, iTunes would be a great place to check it out.
And if you can't find it, just type in Addicted to Fame, the title, and it'll send you to a site. I think even YouTube and Amazon has it as well.
Thank you. David Giancola, the director of the new documentary about Anna Nicole Smith, Addicted to Fame. But we're not done yet, folks. We have our wonderful friend, true crime writer Donna Kaufman, who has a new book coming out. Or is it out yet? I don't know.
No, I'm still working on one right now that will be out in time for next year. It'll have the Kennedy assassination in it, which will be the 50th year. Dr. Cyril West, who I write with, is the person who, the first independent medical examiner who was allowed into the archives and discovered that, among other things, JFK's brain was missing. So he's been on that case since 63 when he was a young man and has never stopped being on the case, you know, and the new book will also have a bunch of other, I can't even tell you how interesting this one's going to be, but, you know, that's for next year.
This year.
The thing that I just wanted to mention that Howard K. Stern, Doctors Chris Rostovich, and who was Anna's neighbor and psychiatrist, and Dr. Sandeep Kapoor, who was her internist, were all charged with overprescribing her medicine. I was in the courtroom for some of that trial here in Los Angeles. And the judge at the time was wildly on the side of the defendants and really kind of shamefully so. I mean, it was a bizarre thing to observe. And the jury found them guilty on a number of charges, not Sandeep Kapoor. He was cleared of everything. But Anna and, Rostovich and Stern were found guilty, and the judge just said, forget it. You know, they couldn't have known. She's a celebrity. She deserves to have phony prescriptions and phony names.
Oh,
and he basically
terrible.
Expunged everything. An appeals court stepped in and said, no, you don't. You've got to sentence these guys. They are guilty. We're reestablishing these convictions as the jury wanted. And so now the same judge has to decide how he's going to punish these two people. And what he could do, given his predilection, is decide that these were not felonies, they were misdemeanors, and, give them a $100 fine each. Or he could retry Rostovich. So that remains to be seen.
I need a spatula.
But, it doesn't end.
My jaw is on the floor. You mean this judge didn't want to punish these people for supplying all of this crap to Anna Nicole Smith? That is just ridiculous. I can't.
He basically accepted the defense theory that celebrities deserve different treatment. And he also said you can't over-prescribe pain medicine because pain is a very personal thing. And so, the proof and the stuff that the prosecutors argued was really ignored. And, they had the nannies in there talking about how Howard put all the little pill bottles in front of Anna, would wake her up to give her more medicine. And it was, it's all in my book, and it's very shocking. But we'll see what happens. It's not over.
Quickly, the subtext of the film Addicted to Fame is, that people are people and celebrities are people and they should be held to the same standard.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Donna, what is the name of your book and when is it coming out?
The new one, I don't know what the name is, but the one that's out now, I have the one with Anna Nicole and her son is called A Question of Murder. And our more recent one with Casey Anthony and Michael Jackson is called From Crime Scene to Courtroom. And that's also being, well received.
Oh, yeah. We love your books, Donna.
We got the famous cases in there, and then plus really twisty cases. If you're a mystery lover, you can't get more real and more warped than these kinds of cases that we write about. Dr. West has done 56,000 cases in his career, so we have a lot to choose from.
Well, Donna, we'll get that link up on WebSleuth so everybody can see it. Donna Kaufman and director-writer David Giancola, thank you both for joining us tonight on Trisha's True Crime Radio. We'll have you back soon, and I can't wait to see this documentary. It sounds absolutely amazing and a very tragic tale indeed. Thank you both for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And hello.
Hello?
Candy Rose, two great people.
Oh, yeah, Mark Klass and Candy Rose, they are fantastic. Thank you, and they'll be on a little bit later. Thanks, guys. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, wow, that is so tragic. And, you know, it's been 5 years, and there's still a lot of story to tell about Anna Nicole Smith, and I'm sure this is definitely not the end of it, not even close. Later on, we're going to have a Candy Rose on to talk about the Abraham Shakespeare case. Dee Dee Moore is on trial for the murder of Abraham Shakespeare. She is accused of killing him for his money. He was a lottery winner. And that is a, speaking of twisted cases, that is a twisted, sick, sick case. But right now, we're going to go to one of the cases that is generating a lot of interest on Web Sleuth. And that is Dylan Redwine, the case of missing teenager Dylan Redwine. Now, we have some Web Sleuth members who have done some amazing work. TXJ 1971 came up with a timeline for Mark Redwine, that is Dylan's father. We have some quotes generated by the poster Confusion and the Dylan brief notes. We have some other notes generated by our Web Sleuth member. Her name is Vasport Mom. So thank you so much to all three of you. I'm looking at this work you have done, and it is better than any mainstream media, any Nancy Grace, anything I've ever seen. I would wager to say that law enforcement would love to see this because it is put together in such an amazing way. But let's get to the case right now. Okay, Dylan Redwine didn't really want to go spend time with his dad, according to his mom and his aunt. He wanted to spend the holiday with his other family members. He was last seen in public on Sunday, November 18th. I believe it was at Walmart. Now, here's the deal. According to Dylan's mother, she said that his dad, Mark Redwine, said he last saw his son around 7:30 Monday morning, November 19th, and then noticed he wasn't around at 11 a.m., reported him missing about 4:30 that day. Now, Dylan's cell phone and charger and various other items were in his backpack, which he supposedly had with him. It's not at his father's house, supposedly. Now, the mother was awarded sole custody of Dylan on September 21st. Previously, she and Mark Redwine had shared custody, and apparently it was a very contentious deal. It was not a good thing. Dylan texted his mother on Sunday to let her know he had arrived and his father had picked him up, and that was the last she heard from him. It also included an icon of a frown, I believe, so, some sort of icon signaling disappointment, unhappiness, if you will. Now, there's a lot more. Dylan had plans to meet his friends Sunday night, then he changed it to Monday morning. Dylan never contacted his friends on Monday. Nobody heard from him. His dad said that he tried to wake him up to get him to come with him to run errands, but he was too tired. And then he did speak to him and told him he'd be back later. According to what Mark Redwine says, he got back at 11:30. There was a cereal bowl in the sink and Nickelodeon on the TV. The backpack was gone. The fishing pole was gone. But a few articles of clothing remained. There's nothing on his cell since he was reported missing, and this is a kid that has used his cell nonstop. Now, here is something that is very shocking. Elaine Redwine, Dylan's mom, told ABC News she believes her ex-husband was upset that she was given the court-mandated primary custody of their son. Here's what she said. I don't think Mark treats him very well. I would not put it past Mark to have done something to remove Dylan from the situation. You know, like, if I can't have him, nobody will. He hasn't had any contact with us. My older son tried to get a hold of him by texting him, and he wouldn't respond. She went on to say, I just find it odd that at a time like this, he would be so evasive. And I agree, that is very, very odd. And we welcome, once again, to our show, to Trisha's True Crime Radio, one of our dearest friends, Mark Klass of the Klass Kids Foundation. And Mark, everybody is truly waiting on the edge of their seat. They want to know what you think of the Dylan Red Wine case. What are your thoughts? What do you think happened? Is there somebody responsible? Let's hear it from unfortunately somebody who has been through this horrible nightmare before and knows what's going on. Mark Klass?
Well, good evening, Tricia. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. I just wish sometimes it could be under different types of circumstances.
I agree.
I've followed this case, as have so many other people, and like so many, I'm too disturbed by the father's behavior. I mean, it just seems to be downright cruel towards other family members. And he is the last person to see the little boy. He has had issues with law enforcement in the past, and he does seem to have a violent temper on occasion. And quite frankly, this whole business of him saying that he doesn't want to do media so that law enforcement can get on with the investigation doesn't really make sense to me on any other level anyway, given the fact that his being on media shouldn't impose upon the investigation one way or the other. So he's making it very, very difficult for anybody to eliminate him as a potential suspect in this case.
And that's true. And you know who else said that he didn't want to do media because he didn't want to take away from the search? Scott Peterson. That's exactly what he said. That's why he wasn't going to talk about Lacey, because he wanted to have the focus remain on Lacey. We all know about that case. Well, one of the main questions that people are asking me to ask you, do you believe this was an abduction? Well, maybe perhaps a stranger abduction, or I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Well, everybody is, at this point, law enforcement and family members have discounted the possibility of him having run away. Apparently, they do have some dogs that have followed a scent, although the scent was late in coming, to the lake. And while the father says that he loved to go fishing, was a country kind of a boy, the mother discounts that and says no. And his brother discount that and say, no, he was an urban kid. He'd much rather be playing video games than out hiking, hunting, and or fishing. Now, the idea that everybody also agrees that he was familiar with hitchhiking and did hitchhike.
Yes,
but
he did.
The only road between his father's home and the friends, it's about 12 miles and or a 30-minute trip, is a remote road that exists between those two communities. So if, in fact, he was kidnapped, which I think is very remote, he was most likely taken by a local resident. And
okay.
If that's the case, other people in the family might know about that. They should be able to understand suspicious behavior within a family member, and that then should be brought to the attention of law enforcement. But to the best of my knowledge, none of that has been done. So that then brings us all the way back to two possibilities. Number one, the father is somehow involved, as the mother has said, her intuition leads her to believe, and or the boy somehow fell down a sinkhole and disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah, and we kind of know that is not likely at all. One thing that Elaine Redwine said, and I want to bring this out, again, this is from one of our incredible members on Web Sleuths. She said, I was married to Mark for a lot of years, and I know the way he reacts to things. If Dylan maybe did or said something that wasn't what Mark wanted to hear, I'm just afraid of how Mark would have reacted. Now, Mark, we have to remember that Dylan didn't want to go see his dad. He wanted to stay home with his family. So here you have this man who is obviously has issues with anger. He's just been told basically by the court in so many words, you're not a good enough father to have joint custody. He picks up his son. I mean, 13-year-old boys, let me tell you, they can have an attitude that can really annoy you, and they can try the patience of a saint. Trust me, I know. So here you have this dad who's already kind of a, you know, has issues with anger. You have to wonder if what Elaine Redwine is saying is true. You know, did Dylan say something and that's all it took?
Well, you know what? I mean, I think that quote that you came from her might have come from a
Nancy Grace program that I participated in, because I've heard that before. But mm-hmm. you know what? Again, Tricia, he's making it so incredibly difficult to discount the things that she says because he's maintaining a bunker mentality. And the reality is that when your child is missing, that a bunker mentality is the last thing that you should be adopting. What you should be doing is getting out there and advocating on behalf of your missing child. If it seems to the community that parents aren't interested in recovering the child through words and or actions, then it becomes even more difficult to get the community involved in the recovery, as you and I have seen so many times. This continues, you know, right now for Sierra Lamar, happened for Michelle Lay, happened for Linnea Lomax, and all, you know, the Amber Harris, and all of the cases that you and I have worked together. But Mr. Redwine, you know, refuses to participate in any of that, which, number one, lends credence to the things that his mother said. And remember, his mother, as soon as she found out that he was missing, jumped in a car and made the lengthy, whatever it was, 13-hour trip down to participate in the recovery of her son. And again, this guy is not contacting the family. He's being cruel. He's treating them badly. He's hiding from the media. The only people he seems to be talking to are law enforcement, and you have to credit him for that. But there is so much more that he can be doing that he's not doing, that it, again, redirects suspicion upon himself.
When you say that Mark Redwine is being cruel to his family, do you have uh-huh. specifics, or what have you heard?
Yeah. Sure, no. The whole idea that the other son, Corey, with whom he has a contentious relationship, was trying to contact him in the aftermath of finding out that Dylan had been reported missing or was missing, and his refusal to get back in touch with Corey and or Elaine is cruel behavior. The boy is missing. He was the last one to see him alive, and now he's refusing to talk to anybody about that. My goodness, that would drive me right through the roof. As
oh, make me crazy.
As relations can be between parents of a missing child, particularly that have had a difficult relationship themselves, they almost always come together for the child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's because, listen, we're all invested in our children. We want the best things for our children. Therefore, if something goes haywire and or our children go missing, we rally the wagons around and do whatever is necessary to resolve the problem successfully.
And in your case, your daughter Polly was kidnapped and murdered. You were divorced from Polly's mom. You two came together. I remember it very well. And you did what you had to do, correct?
Oh, absolutely, sure. We did. Sierra Lamar's mom and dad, you know, they've been divorced for some years, but you know what? They're both there every Saturday for the search, and whatever differences they have between each other, they completely put those aside and work together to bring the little girl home, as have so many parents. Good Lord, Trisha, you know this as well as
mm-hmm.
I do.
That's
of all
right.
of these cases, that you just do what you have to do for your kid. And
absolutely.
It's not happening in this case.
We're talking with Mark Klass of the Klass Kids Foundation about missing teenager Dylan Redwine. He went to stay with his dad, his father, Mark Redwine. He's not being named a suspect, but he's acting very strange. He's being cruel to other family members. He won't talk to the family about the missing boy at all. He had lost, I don't want to say lost custody, but he was told he could not be the primary custody caregiver to his son, and shortly before the arrival of his son, so I'm sure he was not too happy about that. Now, here's a question that's driving everybody nuts on Web Sleuths, Mark, and I think I know the answer, and I want to see if it's the same as yours. Why, if Mr. Redwine, the dad, is considered a suspect by the police, even though the police aren't saying he is, why would they let him participate in the search yesterday?
Well, just to observe him.
Exactly.
To observe him, to see what he does, where he goes, how he acts and reacts. Sure,
exactly.
That would be the reason for that. And it would be a natural thing for him to do, to participate in a search. And I think that if he didn't participate in the search, then you have some very real questions. And again, Tricia, I'd like to draw the parallels between this case and the case of baby Ale Reynolds. Up there you had a father who, again, refused to talk to media except for a very brief time, did not really participate in any of the searches, seemed even reluctant to put a flyer of his missing daughter up on his own front door, and left a lot of unanswered questions about what happened in the house that evening, to the point where law enforcement says they don't believe all of the things that he's saying, particularly the fact that there may be omissions. So you have these guys that continually turn the attention back on themselves.
And that's exactly what Mark Redwine is doing in this case, in my opinion. Mark, you mentioned there's two sides to this with a parent searching. I know that Brad Dennis, your director of search of the Class Kids search team, sometimes you really don't want the mom or dad going on a search in case they find the body. Is that right, or am I not remembering correctly?
Oh, no, that's exactly right. But oftentimes families want to go on the search.
If
so
they want to go.
Then,
yeah.
If they want to go, you can't really keep a determined parent from doing that. And if they want to go, then what you do is you put them on a low probability search team, a search
mm-hmm.
team that is maybe been set up simply to get the parents into the field to do the searching they want to do, but without any great probability of finding the missing person. Or what will happen is what happened in the case of Linnea Lomax earlier this summer. The mom demands to go out on the search, that she wants to find the little girl or her missing daughter, and ends up being the person that finds her remains. And I can tell you that in that particular case, I think many of us were very, very concerned about the well-being of Maya, the mother, after she had found her daughter. But when I talked to her about a month later, she seemed to have come through just the endless crying and the terrible grief and I guess the immense shock that she experienced in finding her daughter's remains, and had realized that, and these are very religious people, had realized that her wish to God or her prayer to God was to let me find my daughter, and that in that sense her prayers were answered. But she had a fallback position. I mean, she had this deep faith to fall back on. And I don't know that everybody else does, and I just don't think that the last image you want of your child is to find their decomposing remains somewhere out in the wild.
Absolutely right. We're talking with Mark Klass, and we're talking about the Dylan Redwine case. Dylan's been missing since November 19th. He went to stay with his father in Colorado and hasn't been seen since. And we're talking about the fact that that law enforcement, let Mark Redwine join in on a search. And the question was, if he was considered a suspect, why would they let him search? Well, because they want to see how he acts. How does he react? Where does he go? I wonder, Mark, and I'd like you to weigh in on this, with Mark Redwine searching, did they put him in a particular area that they wanted to see how he would react to being there? I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know that they have anything that would lead them to any particular area at this point in time. Hopefully they've got more than they're letting on, but this truly does seem to be a situation where the last time the child was seen was on the Walmart video, which was shortly after he arrived and was seen on the video at the Durango airport. And then you have almost a 22-hour period from that moment to the time he was ultimately reported missing to law enforcement. An awful lot can happen. You can go to an awful lot of places during that time period, secret a body, and get back. So how in the world is law enforcement going to have too much of an idea of where this child might be in this incredibly rural environment that exists in southern Colorado.
Exactly. Mark, we have some questions from Web Sleuths members. One of them coming from our chat room. Do you think, in your opinion, that it was cruel of Dylan's mom to go on national TV and basically, she didn't come out and say it, but everybody could read between the lines, that she was accusing him of doing something to Dylan? I understand why she did it. The guy's not talking to anybody. He's being a jerk to the family. I think I'd go on TV and say that too, wouldn't you, or am I wrong?
You know what? I think I was on a program with her where she was really trying to dial some of that back. Mm-hmm. And I think that she probably spoke, I don't know, we don't know these people, Tricia. We know that
right.
There's an incredibly contentious relationship between them. And the fact that, you know, as soon as they found out he was missing and then tried to get back in touch with the father, and he refused to have any contact with him or to respond to their either phone calls or text messages, I think is enough that it would send somebody into an emotional tailspin or a need to somehow strike back. It's probably not the best thing she could have done, but it just may be human nature at its most typical.
And emotional, you know, at its most emotional.
Sure.
Absolutely. It seems that law enforcement has been discouraged from calling in Texas EquiSearch or even yourself. Do you know anything about that?
Well, they've got a good volunteer effort going right now. I think that yesterday they had something like 260 people that
mm-hmm.
were involved in the search, and they've also got a multi-agency task force that includes local, state, and the FBI, federal law enforcement agencies. So, you know, typically we don't get involved in a case this early on. You understand that and know that.
Yes.
That it's usually some weeks that have gone by, and oftentimes the media attention is starting to die down, that family members will contact us or law enforcement will contact us. And also, Tricia, an awful lot of agencies don't trust unaffiliated, nonprofit, volunteer search efforts. Again, we understand that and can deal with that. That's why we need to be asked either by family members and or law enforcement. And I think in the vast majority of instances, we're much more likely to be called in by family members than we are by the local authorities.
Yeah, it seems like from just my limited experience, and you, Mark Klass, certainly have a lot more than I do, it always seems like law enforcement kind of gets their, you know, hackles up when a search, like you said, a nonprofit search crew comes in. It's like they're feeling threatened or insulted. It's very odd. And I know you are working very hard to change that perception, and you certainly have in many, many cases. So do you think, let's say, I'm trying to get some questions here from our chat room. We have so many going on right now. Did you see the picture of Dylan at Walmart? Have you seen that picture?
I haven't seen the Walmart picture, but I've seen the airport picture.
Do you think he looked unhappy at all?
He didn't look overjoyed. I mean,
yeah.
He certainly didn't look thrilled, and he did apparently send his mom that frowning emoticon on the way on the way out of the airplane to go meet with his dad. So sure, he wasn't having a good time. But let me comment just a little bit on this whole idea of law enforcement getting their hackles up when groups like ours are called in. And there's no question about that, but I think that sometimes they don't understand the motivation of groups like ours. We know specifically that our job is to search. That's all we do. You know that. We don't get involved with money. We don't get involved with investigation. We don't get involved with a lot of things. But on the other hand, you have organizations that will insert themselves into an investigation by sending moles into the family unit to try to extract information. That doesn't always go very well at all. And I think that if groups stuck to what they do know how to do and their area of expertise, that you might find more cooperation with law enforcement. But the only organization that I can speak for is the Class Kids Foundation, and then I think to some extent our wonderful friends down at Laura Recovery Center as well, because I know both of them do understand what it is we do, what we should be doing, and we stick very close to that script.
And Mark, you're right. It's a perception. It's something I deal with on Web Sleuths all the time with law enforcement. The perception that you're coming in to interfere and to do things is what you're dealing, is what you're up against, because you know Class Kids and the Search Center would never, ever do anything to interfere with law enforcement's investigation. You would never do that. So you are dealing with an incorrect perception that you need to change, and you are changing it. And I'm grateful that you work so hard at it, and you do have a stellar reputation, I can tell you that, without any question. So let's just go over it quickly here. We're talking with Mark Class from the Class Kids Foundation about Dylan Redwine. Okay, Dylan's a 13-year-old kid. He loves his cell phone. He's not a big outdoorsy type kid. His father, a few months before, was just told that he was not going to be the primary custodian in the in court. He was told that the mom basically got primary custody. This is a court-ordered visitation to make up for a Thanksgiving weekend. So he arrives at the airport. Dylan arrives at the airport. We have him on tape. And he sends his mom a frowny face saying that he's arrived. He's not happy to be here. He's in Walmart. Doesn't look too happy either. And then Monday, the 19th, he disappears. He doesn't take his phone. He doesn't use his phone at all. And that's all he ever did was use his phone, apparently. His fishing pole is gone, but yet he wasn't really a fishing-type kid. And his backpack was gone, but some of his clothes were left. You have a father who has a violent temper, a violent past, who basically lost joint custody of his child, who won't return phone calls to his other son when they call to talk to him about the missing teenager. And he is cooperating with law enforcement, which is good, but he's basically saying he doesn't want to go in front of the media, and he's acting kind of like a jerk to people around him. All of that, Mark, how many times have we sat back and seen something similar to this? It's not always exact, but it's similar, and it becomes more and more obvious who is responsible. It doesn't look good right now for Mark Redwine, and that's all his fault.
But you know what, Tricia? Sometimes these kinds of cases get solved, and you have all of these red flags pointing at these guys, and law enforcement is able to put enough together to finally resolve the situation, make an arrest, and get these guys behind bars where they need to be. Scott Peterson would be the perfect example. But then other times you have all of these red flags, and the case goes absolutely nowhere, and I think a very good example of that would be the Ale Reynolds case.
Mm-hmm.
That there's not been any kind of an arrest, there's been no movement on this case at all, and then sometimes these things go completely haywire and go just right down the tubes and end in some kind of a horrible tragedy, as in the case of oh my goodness, what's her name, the girl from Salt Lake City, Susan Powell.
Yes,
in the case
exactly.
Where everybody, the authorities knew what this guy Josh had done, but for some unimaginable reason, they allowed him to chop his children's heads off and burn them up in a flaming inferno.
That I can't even talk about that, Mark. It is so upsetting that was allowed to happen. And you know, and we'll get off track here a little bit, but you know Susan Powell's parents. You've seen them like I have. And they are absolutely so strong and so amazing. And they're still out there fighting for Susan and their boys. You know, they've got a lawsuit against the government agency that allowed this monster to take those two boys. That never should have happened. I mean, it's so obvious, isn't it? That's what's so frustrating.
Well, they should have made an arrest. They should have arrested that character almost immediately, but they failed to do so. I think if they are going to be suing somebody, it needs to be the local agency that allowed this to percolate and flare up as it did. It's just unbelievable.
And
but we digress.
Yes, we do. I mean, it's so easy to digress because that is such a tragic case, and unbelievable too. Let's see. Let's go to the chat room. We do have some questions here. Do you know if he had a Facebook account or a MySpace account, Mark? I haven't heard that yet. Have you?
If Dylan did?
Yes.
I haven't heard that, but of course he did. I mean, his mother said, everybody said he's tech savvy. He never puts his cell phone down. That, you know, she has mentioned that she was on the verge of getting him a smartphone for Christmas. So I don't think that there's any way in the world this guy didn't have social media accounts. It wouldn't make any sense not to.
Somebody on the chat room now from WebSleuth is just saying he had two Facebook accounts, which doesn't surprise any of us at all whatsoever.
I'll tell you the one thing, though, is, well, I guess he's 13, and you do have to be 13, supposedly, to open a Facebook account. But as we know, millions and millions of kids under the age of 13 have them as well.
Oh, exactly. I mean, they're so easy to do. You just have to check a box and say that you're 13. I mean, hello, all the kids are going to lie to get on there, absolutely. Now, do you think law enforcement, I think law enforcement is focusing on the time that Mark Redwine says Dylan went missing. And I think they're focusing on everything. But don't you think they're meticulously going through Mark Redwine's day right now? I mean, looking at security cameras, seeing where he went. I think there's a lot more going on here than what we know, don't you think?
I think that first of all, I think we better be careful before we assume too much about this guy because, you know, everything that we have that we're hearing about him is coming from third-party sources.
Well, that's very true.
Law enforcement, for one, is saying that he is being cooperative. But if he is guilty of something, I think that he did a good job of establishing an alibi for himself that day. But remember, he picked his son up at around 7 o'clock in the evening, and he then, it was 12 hours later almost, when he said he left. And I think those are the 12 hours that need a lot of consideration. I think that he's smart enough to establish an alibi for himself for the time when he said that he didn't see the child. But remember, he said he couldn't get the boy up at 7:30. The mom said that he was an early riser. He had no problem getting up in the morning and that he was very anxious about getting to see his friends. So the idea that a perfectly healthy boy is going to feign sleep when the one thing he wants to do is get out of the house and go visit his friends, again, is a pretty hard pill to swallow.
Absolutely, it is. Well, Mark Klass, we're going to be following this very closely, and I'm sure we're going to have you back on again. But let's talk about the Klass Kids Foundation while we wrap this up. This is the time of year that everybody is giving, and Mark, you never, ever ask for donations. And I'm going to ask you now to ask for donations because Klass Kids, you survive on donations. You go into areas to search for children and for adults at times. You charge nothing. You never, ever charge a cent. You pay for it all. You pay for as much as you can yourself. It's amazing what you do. And you just survive on donations, right?
Well, we do. We don't have any grants, Tricia. And you know that, and you're aware of that. And so much of our work is done by our amazing volunteers, including the wonderful people of WebSleuth who support us, you know, so ably when we go into remote areas or go into areas to find missing kids. Support us by giving us, arranging for food to be delivered to search centers. Support us in so many other ways, have supported us financially in the past. But you know what? We are a nonprofit. Donations are tax deductible. And I would like to encourage your listeners to join us by including the Klass Kids Foundation in your charitable giving for 2012. In 2012, Klass Kids Search and Rescue provided services and assistance in 83 cases of missing and or trafficked persons. In 23 of those cases, Klass Kids Search and Rescue provided search and rescue services. 17 of those cases have been resolved and 6 of them remain open. We advocate legislation. We do everything we can to create a safer world for our kids. And we'd love it if your great folks can help us even in more ways to accomplish those goals.
Well, Mark, we're going to put up this information on Web Sleuths and encourage everybody to donate. You know, if everybody who came on Web Sleuths just one day, all the people that came on Web Sleuths on one day donated $5, you could certainly have everything you need for the year 2013. There would be no question. But even if it's a dollar, that would be great. But any more, I mean, anything you could do would be greatly appreciated.
That's absolutely true, Tricia. And again, this is the season of giving. We all do it. And we can all take advantage of that tax benefit as well.
And where do they go to donate, Mark? Give us the address.
Oh, you know what? It's at classkids.org, K-L-A-A-S-K-I-D-S.org. And, Tricia, we will be introducing a brand-new website, a redesigned classkids.org, in early January to commemorate Polly's 32nd birthday, which would have been her 32nd birthday. And we're going to be offering a whole array of new technologies and new services that we think can go a long way towards making this a better and safer place for all of our kids. But until then, we're stuck with the great website that we do have. And I would like to finish by wishing your wonderful listeners a Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season.
Well, thank you, Mark, and on behalf of the thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of people that come to Web Sleuths, if not millions, through the year 2012, we want to thank you for all you do and the foundation does for people who are going through that living nightmare that you went through, a missing child. So thank you, Mark. You know, we're always there for you. Go to classkids.org to donate. You can do it through PayPal. I will put up a link here after the show on Web Sleuths to make it easier. Anything you could donate would be greatly appreciated. Remember, even if it's just a buck, if we can get 20,000 people to donate a dollar, it would certainly help out a lot. Mark Class, thank you so much. Give my love to Violet and everybody, and we'll be in touch very soon, okay?
Okay, thank you, darling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I love that man, his family, his wife and everybody. They are just the most amazing people. Okay, now we are going to switch to one of the oddest cases I have ever been involved with. And I say involved with because Web Sleuths became involved. And our goal is not to ever become involved in a case. It's just to help law enforcement come up with better ideas. We write down the stuff on the forum. They come and read it, and hopefully that helps them. The case of Abraham Shakespeare, a homeless man who won, I believe, was $34 million, spent most of it, but he still had some of it left when he met a Black Widow spider named Dee Dee Moore. Dee Dee Moore came up to Abraham and said, "Hey, honey, I'm going to write your biography. I'm going to write your life story." She wasn't a writer. She was a scam artist. Anyway, so he hands over his power of attorney to her. He has, I think, a couple million left by this time. Hands over his power of attorney, supposedly. We didn't even know if he really did that. I kind of think he didn't. And then he promptly disappears. So, our wonderful Web Sleuths members are discussing this case, how Dee Dee Moore, when Abraham Shakespeare meets up with Dee Dee Moore, he disappears, and our members are putting together this amazing timeline and all this information about Dee Dee Moore, about, you know, the things she's done in the past and about her houses and her money, and it was absolutely incredible. It was so incredible that one of the investigators called me and wanted me to post to our members saying thank you, that what the members of Web Sleuths had done had helped the case so much that they couldn't even say. They were so grateful to what the Web Sleuths members had done. And, see, I'm losing my voice. It gets so much better. Dee Dee Moore writes me and is threatening me, you know, with lawsuits and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. I get threatened constantly. And I shouldn't say that. That's an exaggeration, but it's a good story. Anyway, I do get threatened occasionally with lawsuits and other things. Anyway, Dee Dee Moore said she was going to sue me if I didn't take it down. And I said, well, why don't you join and defend yourself? Never thinking in my wildest dreams she would do that. Well, she did just that. She joined Web Sleuths. I think she made something like 37 posts, and they were just blabbering posts, making her look so much worse. And law enforcement contacted me again and said, just let her go. And I said, I don't care what rule she violates. She can post whatever she wants. Anyway, then here's the weird part, if you can imagine it gets weirder. She contacts me, says it was her friend posting for her, trying to help her. It really wasn't her. And I write back and I say, well, Dee Dee, that's kind of strange because the internet provider address on this email is the same internet provider address that was used to make the post. So it came from your computer. Well, then her story changed, and it was her 14-year-old son that was posting. Then supposedly her 14-year-old son started posting and saying, it was me, call me, call me, call me. And I'm trying to remember, please forgive me if I get this wrong, but I think I did call him, and he didn't sound like a 14-year-old boy, I think. It was so long ago, I can't remember. So long ago, so many crazy people, it's just hard to keep up. And speaking of keeping up, there's one person on the internet that keeps up with these crazy, wacky cases like nobody else in the universe. And that is our well-loved and appreciated Candy Rose. And ladies and gentlemen, you're going to hear Candy Rose tonight on Trisha's True Crime Radio. Candy Rose, I will call you ACR. Welcome, my wonderful and loving friend. How are you?
Oh, thank you. I'm fine right now. I'm a much better than I was, you know, a couple of months ago, but I'm doing much better.
Yes, you are, and we're very grateful for that. Now, you keep up all kinds of timelines. You started with the JonBenet Ramsey case. That's how we got to know each other, with that amazing timeline and all that information. But you've also taken up the Abraham Shakespeare case. Now, I gave a really rough draft of the case. What did I miss? What would you like to fill in?
No, you did cover quite a bit of it there. When she came onto the forum, I have to say that, I don't follow every single one of the cases on the Web Sleuths forum, but when I got on there with the Abraham case, I was just amazed. Of course, I didn't know it at immediately that there was a little backstory there, but mm-hmm. I was amazed that you were allowing us to say and do as much as we were.
That's right.
And even some of the other people, I mean, the sleuthers were just going to town, and I was like mind-boggled going, you know, Trisha's going to slap their hands any minute because they're posting stuff on here, and, you know, I'm trying to, you know, capture it as fast as I can because, you know, I want to do more sleuthing, and I, you know, they were giving me a lot of good tips on there, and then, you know, it was so mind-boggling because they literally found the house, the address, the property records, her boyfriend, everything, before we ever even knew that he was buried in the backyard.
I know. And you know what?
And it was,
go ahead.
It was. I mean, it was, after we found out, I'm like, oh, my God, we were actually, we had pictures of the house. You know, there was one of the posters had gotten somebody to drive by and get a picture of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And it was utterly amazing the amount. I mean, you must have had, I don't know, probably a dozen, two dozen threads early on the case because we were just going to town on stuff, you know. But anyway, we finally, you know, and when she came on, when she was posting, that was just mind-boggling. I don't know. I don't know offhand if I could think of any other case where somebody from the case came on and, you know, was chatting away like that.
Not like this.
Yeah, and then yeah, you're right. And she did. She pretended it was her son. And when he came on, I do remember that there was a couple of posters that, because he even posted a phone number, said, you know, if you don't believe it's me, here's my phone number. And
right.
A couple of the posters actually called. Because he was, I think he was only 14 at the time, and they were like, you know, legally can he even come on like that at 14? So they were, you know, questioning that, but, it was just, it was mind-boggling to watch it back then on the Web Sleuths forum. And, but then it got kind of slow after a while, after they had finally arrested her, and of course now we got the trial going on, and I'm telling you, just this week, I mean, it's been a bumpy first 10 days for poor old Dee Dee.
Tell us about that. Tell us what Dee Dee's hysteria, how Detective Clark did. I mean, let's hear the story. You're the goddess of all of this. Candy Rose talked about Dee Dee Moore's trial. You are on, my dear.
Well, the judge had scolded her a half a dozen times, if not more. And, I mean, she would either go into trying to make eye contact with the jury or making her little faces that, you know, show either approval or disapproval to a witness or toward the jury. And then she'd go into her crying act, and this girl could, you know, pour tears like, you know, you can pour buckets of water. And if she wasn't doing that, then she was shuffling papers and writing notes at the defense table at a rapid rate, pretty much like Casey Anthony used to do, you know, acting like their legal secretaries or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just got to the point where there was a couple of times the judge had to stop the case. And in order for her to go and, you know, she was complaining because the things on her legs were too tight and they were hurting her legs.
It's the restraints,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess the judge had made a comment that, you know, they could change it, but it wasn't going to be much more comfortable, that they suggested she wear socks. And she claimed she had a kidney infection. I think she was trying to, you know, stall on the get out of the courtroom is what she wanted to do.
Right.
Every time somebody would get up there and start talking. At one point, she did, well, I think the jury was out of the room by then, but she did burst out and say that she was sick of people lying about her and to the judge, and he wasn't too, the judge is excellent. I mean, he was not going to put up with her bull.
Mm-hmm, good.
And, yeah, so that was very good. She had the first witness was her ex-husband. He admitted he dug the hole. He thought it was trash, and I guess she thought Abraham was trash.
Yeah.
Anyway, he dug the hole, and he came back a couple hours later, filled the hole, but he never looked inside. He was just basically doing a job because his business was construction and backhoe business.
Don't you think, let me just stop you for 1 second. Don't you think it is just shows just what a manipulative, horrid human being Dee Dee Moore is by the fact she was able to get her ex-husband to dig the grave of the man she was murdering? Now, he didn't know that at the time, but my God, she could look at what she does. She is such a manipulator.
Oh, yeah. Well, by the time she confessed, she blamed her 14-year-old son for shooting Abraham.
Yeah, what a scumbag.
You know, and if that wasn't bad enough, she used her mother's truck to try to haul the body out of there. It's like, hello, you got your entire family involved. You know?
They don't even know it. So, okay, so now she's freaking out and she's causing all kinds of problems. Tell us about some of the witnesses that you heard a bit about.
Well, when they brought on Greg Smith, now he was a confidential informant. Well, he wasn't originally. He was a good friend, long-term friend of Abraham's. He's probably got a little seedy background of his own. And he runs a barbershop. Anyway, he was a barber. And he borrowed money off Abraham, as, you know, 100 other people did. And he was in the process of paying back. Well, when Dee Dee was, you know, so-called, quote-unquote, writing the, you know, Abraham's life history and decided to become his financial advisor,
mm-hmm.
then Greg Smith had met Dee Dee because she was supposed to be taking over collecting money from the people that he had loaned money to, Abraham loaned. So
right.
That's how she got involved with Greg Smith. But then she obviously knew a little bit about, I would think she must have known a little bit about Greg's past history of, you know, a little seediness on his own. For her to approach him, I mean, it's hard to believe she just approached somebody she thought was, like, honest and would just, you know, do all this stuff for her. But she approached him to go and make a phone call for her to say that he had seen Abraham. He didn't know he was calling a detective. But he found out later he did, but he didn't know at the time. So he, you know, for $300, which she paid him, he agreed to call this number and say, yeah, I saw Abraham. And then she wanted him to call Abraham's mother Now, he had never met Abraham's mother. He had no idea who she was. He only knew Abraham. And so she had him call Abraham's mother and pretend he was Abraham.
So he called
and said, you know, hi, this is Abraham, Mom, you know, I'm, you know, so forth. I don't know the exact words, but that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the mom didn't buy it because she didn't believe that was his voice. And he didn't know until later that he had actually called the mother. So those two first phone calls. But then it was right after that that the police grabbed him when they, I guess him and Dee Dee used to meet up in different places, different parking lots in the mall, and discuss what they did and what's going to do next. And after one of those meetings, the cops grabbed Greg Smith and said, hey, you know, this is what's really going on. You know, we think that she had something to do with his disappearance. And by the way, you know, you called, your first call was to a detective, and he didn't know that. And he goes, and you know, you called her mother, his mother, and he didn't know that either. So, you know, one thing led to another, and before you know it, they talked him into being a confidential informant.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point on, then he continued to have meetings with her, and they recorded all of them. So although they were very interesting, but it was hours and hours. It was like 2 or 3 days we went through of listening to all of these undercover recordings where Greg Smith and Dee Dee Moore were together, you know, and so we had to listen to all those. And then after Greg was on the stand, then they started bringing in some of the detectives, and which detectives were they? Was it
Clark?
It was Clark and a Chris. I can't remember his last name. There was a Chris.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, they were on there. Actually, Greg Smith was one of the, I'm going to almost say, star witnesses, because he was just a world of information, because she was
mm-hmm.
just confiding everything in him. She wanted to find a third person that Greg Smith might know. And there again, this kind of led us to believe that, well, he must have had a little bit of a seedy background to even be
mm-hmm.
able to find a hitman. I mean, listen, you know, we all can't do that.
Right.
So she wanted him to find a hitman so that who had a record and was going to go to jail and for long term and needed some cash, and would he be willing to say that he murdered Abraham and for $50,000. But I mean, what's mind-boggling is that, okay, Greg Smith finds the guy, which he didn't really find a hitman. He found another undercover cop to pretend he was a hitman.
Mm-hmm.
So Greg Smith and the undercover cop go and meet with her, and she's talking to this undercover cop pretending, you know, to be the hitman.
Right.
And she's actually it's almost funny. She's actually negotiating payments. I mean, if you're going to hire a hitman, you're paying your money, he does the job, you walk away, that's the end of it.
That's how arrogant Dee Dee Moore is in this case.
She wanted to make payment arrangements.
Mm.
And, you know, and she came up with other alternatives. Well, how about if I give you a house? How about if I, you know, give you this? How about if I do that? It's like, you know, it was ridiculous. But, you know, that's Dee Dee Moore. I mean, you could see the kind of person she was. Her whole life, to me, my opinion, is that it's greed, money, and that's what she wants. She wants the money.
Absolutely.
And,
so anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go on. No, go on.
I was going to say, so here she is, she's trying to hire a hitman. We've got all this evidence out now. What happened on Friday? What are we left with, and what can we expect tomorrow in court?
On Friday, the state did close their case, but they had, I'm trying to think if it was on, I think it might have been on Thursday or Friday, they had the other star witness on, which was Centora Butler. That was one of Abraham's children's mother. He had two children,
mm-hmm.
and by two different women, and she had the last baby by him. She got on there, and she admitted a lot of stuff about what Dee Dee was doing and how she was doing it, and that really upset Dee Dee. I mean, that was one of the times that Dee Dee went bonkers in court.
Just went nuts.
Yeah, and she was, you know, I'm tired of them lying, you know, and she went into a big crying jag, and the judge had to, you know, postpone everything and had to take the jury out. Yeah, because Santora was up there. They even tried to put up a videotape that Dee Dee had filmed herself of Santora Butler trying to make her out a liar. And as it turned out, I mean, Santora got up there and said, you know, that videotape, number one, wasn't taken in April of 2009. It was actually taken more like in August, because she was pointing out that the house she was standing in front of, where the porch was, she didn't even move in till to August.
Mm-hmm.
And that she was saying that Dee Dee showed up with a camera, said, change clothes, put this on, say this, do this, I'm going to film it, we're going to put this on the internet, we're going to make, you know, see if we can get Abraham to find it. And, you know, we have him come back. Well, you know, the whole time he was dead.
Right.
And so, but Santora didn't know that. So she was going along with it, thinking that, you know, that was going to help get Abraham to come back from wherever he was at in hiding. But,
Go ahead.
Yeah, so that she was on there, but then they brought on the detective who played the undercover cop. He was Detective Mike Smith. He, you know, explained everything about how she told him, of, you know, where everything was and what we had to do. But the final one that was really the killer, and I'm trying like hell to transcribe this tape, but it's the tape is labeled Dee Dee Moore Trial Day 10, Segment 5.
Uh-huh.
And in that one is when the police took her in to the police station to interview her. She wasn't under arrest, and they weren't holding her for anything. They just wanted to interview her. Now, this was several days before they found the body.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, my God, I mean, her thinking is so convoluted, and she switched so many times on the story she was telling him. First she blamed the Greg Smith that he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she turned around and tried to blame this fictitious Ronald. Dee Dee's fictitious Ronald is Casey Anthony Zan. Same thing.
Brother.
So then she tried to blame this Ronald, saying he was some drug dealer. She even said that after Ronald shot him and they took him out of the house, that sometimes she needed stuff, she needed Abraham's signature, so Ronald would come back to the back of the house and pick up the papers, take them to Abraham, get them signed, bring them back to her. The whole time he's dead.
Oh, no.
And she was just going on and on. Then she finally got to the point where she was blaming her own son again. And I'm telling you, this woman was just, that's where they left at that, after that recording. And then the state closed,
mm-hmm.
which that pretty much ended that. So I'm assuming Monday, I don't know whether she's got any, the defense has any witnesses or, you know, but there's a good possibility, I mean, I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
She's going to take the stand.
That she will take the stand.
She can't keep her mouth shut.
She cannot keep her mouth shut.
She is going nuts. I mean, just by what she posted on Web Sleuths, my good heavens, it was unbelievable. She is going to be chomping at the bit. You know, and I tell you, even if she told her lawyers, okay, I won't testify, and the judge asks, you know, do you want to testify? And she should say, on the advice of my lawyers, I'm not going to. She's going to change her mind right then and say, yes, I'll testify. It's going to be a carnival. And if there wasn't such a tragedy behind it, it would be hilarious to watch, because she's nuts. There's nobody crazier. Okay, Candy Rose, give us your website and where people can go to read more about your timeline with Abraham Shakespeare.
Okay, they can go to www.acandyrose.com. And right on the front page, up toward the top, you can see a picture of Abraham. I think he's the, let me see, must be the fourth or fifth over up on the top. My internet's really slow. I'm trying to get my web page up here. And you just click on that, that I have links that go right to him. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, it's when you go to the www.acandyrose.com, and it's the fifth picture over, you can see Abraham there, and you just click on the link, and it takes you to all the various, you know, pages that I've, you know, found on him, whether it's transcripts or photos of the house. I have a thing called a mini timeline recaps, but it's a little more than mini. It's pretty long. I have a who's who property directory. I've got, well, I went through all of his properties, and I don't know whether this is going to aid the particular civil lawyers who are trying to get some of the money back from the property for the two children or not, but if it does, then, you know, go for it. And then I kept track of, you know, as much information as I could, whether it's media or, you know, tidbits from wherever I could get them, relating to as the case was, you know, going on down through 2010. Yeah, that's basically where you can get some information on it.
Well, it's if you go to www.acandyrose.com, you're going to get lost in, you will never want to leave that site. It has not just the Abraham Shakespeare case, but so many other cases. And Acandy Rose, I, for the first time publicly on an airwave, I get to tell you how much we love you and appreciate you and are so grateful that you are with us and on our side. So thank you for all you do, my dear. And if you need any help from us, you know how to get in touch with me, okay?
Okay, you're welcome. And you know, well, I'm assuming most of your guests know where the link is for your site where we've been discussing it, because we've been keeping up with the trial on a daily basis on the Abraham Shaffer Forum.
On the front of the WebSleuth forum page. That's WebSleuth.com/forum. So it'll be right there in a big box. I can just click on it. ACR,
okay.
Thank you so much, my dear. I know this was last minute, but you saved me, and I appreciate it. And
oh,
we'll be
welcome.
Coming back to you about Abraham Shakespeare. We'll keep our fingers crossed that tomorrow Dee Dee jumps on that stand. So thank you so much.
Well, I really hope so. You know, after the Casey Anthony case in Florida, who knows?
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Take care, my dear. I'll talk to you
okay,
soon, okay?
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Kimster, my darling.
Yes, I have been following that case. And by the way, there is a link to the thread that we're all following, the trial, on the very front page of WebSleuth, not the forum page, but the
right.
Where you go to www.websleuth.com. You'll see
it's
a picture
right there
of him on that happy day, he thought, when he won the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
But it ended up winning the lottery costed him his life. So it was kind of weird when the trial started. It was during the same day or the day after they had the biggest lottery win ever that happened weeks ago. Yeah, it was really surreal when I was putting that information on the front page of WebSleuth because I had bought a lotto ticket myself and was anticipating winning $572 million.
Yeah,
which
and it didn't
I
happen,
won, but don't tell anybody, okay? Anyway, but it's very, very sad. And that case, you know, I was, when that first came out, I can't remember if I think I was either a still a member or was a brand new moderator, one of the two, and I was following that case, and the sleuthers, I keep telling everybody, this is so true, it's good that you made me a moderator because I can never be as good a sleuther as our members. They are so much better at it than I am. I'll tell
me
what,
too.
They just blow my mind. I mean, that there was a poster at the time, she's not with us right now, and wish she'd come back and spend the trial with us, but her name was LB Minnesota, and she kind of directed everybody. Another one was Want to Help, and she's been popping in, you know, during the trial, but they were doing so much, and then, of course, Acandy Rose, and there were others. I hate to say names, because, you know, I'm going to miss somebody.
Susan One is one. I mean, there's so
Susan
many.
Susan One, yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. Exactly, yeah. And I was just sitting back watching them just going, oh, holy cow, how are they finding this information?
How do they do this?
It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very good – I use the Abraham Shakespeare case a lot when I'm talking with law enforcement or people that have trouble with web sleuths because they don't understand what we do. And I explain to them, Abraham Shakespeare is a perfect example of what we can do. When I say we, I mean the posters. What the posters can do when they put their minds to it and just, you know, go all out. It is truly, it should be a movie of the week at the very least. I mean, my gosh, it's just such a bizarre story. But there's always bizarre and sad stories. There's too many of them to cover tonight, but we're going to cover one more quickly, and that is the Web Sleuth's hot cold case of the week. Kimster, take it away.
Hi, Tricia. Before I get the horn out, and I do have it right here, everybody's waiting to hear the horn this week, but I wanted to know, did you know that on Web Sleuth you can be listening in on the streets of Chicago and be the first to know the latest in the Chicago gang wars?
No. Tell me about it. I had no idea.
In the private forums of Web Sleuth, there's a thread where members listen together to the public scanners, and it's a very active thread there. And after we talk about this week's cold case, I'll let everybody know how they can be a member of Web Sleuth so they can listen in.
That's right. You know what? That scanner forum is fascinating. You will call in sick from work just to stay home and listen. I promise. It's that good. But it is in our private area, so you do have to join, and we will have that information right after Kimster tells us about the Web Sleuth hot cold case. So, Kimster, get that horn out, and let's get going.
Do, 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 do.
So,
Tricia,
that's home movie.
Ed, I know. It brings tears to my eyes as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes, yes.
As you know, our cold cases are never the same story on Tricia's True Crime Radio. And this week, we have the accused killer already in jail.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that true? Yeah, we always have a twist, don't we? So that's really different. So why is this a cold case, you ask? Because Ashley Lachey Jones is still missing. Let me read the report from DoeNetwork.org. Ashley was last seen at her home with her Aunt Joyce in the Windyke subdivision in Memphis, Tennessee, on September 16, 1996. On that morning, Ashley's mother and stepfather left for work, and her 12-year-old sister left for school, leaving the 4-year-old Ashley in the care of her mother's sister. Around 9 or 9:30, Ashley's mother called home to check on her sister, Joyce, and on Ashley, and Joyce told her about what Ashley had been doing, and Ashley's mom thought she heard Ashley in the background. Following the family's departure from the home that morning and that phone call, Ashley was never seen nor heard from again.
Mm.
Joyce Lindsay, the aunt, was later convicted in Ashley's disappearance of second-degree murder. Now, Tricia, that's what the Doe Network reports, which our members know is a very, you know, good source for missing person information. But the Charlie Project, another well-known website that lists missing persons, has a longer, more detailed story. And I would summarize it here. But then there is another story, and to try to explain both sides would be a radio show in itself. So the other story comes from another of Ashley's aunts who was posting on Web Sleuth last year. She says the family thinks Joyce might be innocent and that we shouldn't believe everything we read, and she explains why on Web Sleuth. So anyway, you just have to check all this out, and hopefully somewhere someone can come up with whether or not Ashley's aunt is guilty and how to find out how we can find Ashley. So if you want to try to help find Ashley Jones, please go to www.websleuth.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a picture of Ashley along with the link to her thread. You can also join our members who are monitoring the gangs in Chicago, but only if you're a member of Web Sleuth. So please join today. And Tricia, how much does it cost to join websleuth.com?
Well, oh my flipping heck, I can't fudging believe this. It's absolutely free to join Web Sleuth. We just need an email address, and that's pretty much it. So a legitimate email address, and you are set and ready to rock. Right, Kimster?
That's right. And everybody make sure that you're here 2 weeks from next week, because I'm not going to be here next week. And we're going to go. I'm going to go to a party. I should just invite everybody to the Christmas party. You want to come, Tricia?
Absolutely. I'll be there in a heartbeat. Where am I going?
Absolutely. You're going to be on the radio show alone.
Oh, dear.
And there's not going to be a horn.
I'll blow a horn in your honor, my dear. So, and I have no idea what we're doing next week, but it will be good. I promise you that. Hey, Kimster, thank you for everything. I really, really appreciate you. Have fun at your Christmas party, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. I'll be back here alone. And, of course, we know what fun technical difficulties I'm sure I'll have alone without Kimster. But we do have to do one quick thing. It's really, really quick, and that's called the Trisha's True Crime Radio Legal Goo. The opinions on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and I take no responsibility for them. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely, totally different, separate entity from WebSleuth.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org, just so you know. Thank you so much, everyone. It was a long show, but we packed a lot of information in it. And next week, it's going to be another incredible show. I do promise you that. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.